Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture and discussion sponsored by the Moran Center for Banking and Financial Law at Boston University's School of Law. This lecture is part of the Edward Lane Redeker Speaker Series, which honors the late professor who served as the Moran Center's associate director for 16 years. Speaking on lessons of the subprime crisis will be Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank. Moderating the discussion is Moran Center Director Professor Cornelius Hurley. We begin with an introduction by Boston University President Robert Brown. Dr. Brown.
It's an honor and a privilege to introduce to you today Congressman Barney Frank. First, I should point out to you that the Boston University Charles River campus occupies land in two different congressional districts. Now, we are a large institution, but we're not so large that we have two congressmen all to ourselves. We are exceptionally fortunate, however, that a portion of our campus sits in the 4th Massachusetts District, which has been served so ably by Congressman Frank since 1981. A native of New Jersey, Barney Frank came to Massachusetts to attend Harvard College and later Harvard Law. He made a name for himself as chief assistant to Mayor Kevin White of Boston, and after serving as an assistant to Congressman Michael Harrington, went on to serve in the Massachusetts legislature for 8 years. He was elected to Congress in 1980, and after just one term, faced a long-term incumbent when their districts were combined. Considered to be the underdog in that race, he won with 20% more of the votes cast and has consistently won re-election with the enthusiastic support of his constituents. He is a popular figure inside and outside of his district. He is highly respected for his wit and his intelligence, as well as for his taking committed stands on civil rights issues, including his outspoken defense of gay rights. With the Democratic takeover of Congress in 2006, he assumed the chairmanship of the House Financial Services Committee. There is no person in the country better suited or able to speak on the subprime crisis than Congressman Barney Frank. We are indeed fortunate to have you here today, sir, at the invitation of the Moran Center for Banking and Financial Law to deliver the Edward Lane Redeker Lecture. Congressman Frank, on behalf of our colleagues and our students, welcome to Boston University.
Thank you. I am flattered to be invited and eager to begin, in some cases continue, with a look at friends and others in the audience, an important dialogue. Let me cut right to it. There is now, I believe, a consensus that we have to make some significant changes in the nature of financial regulation and the scope. There is, understandably, less agreement on what it should be. But getting to the point where people do agree that we need some has been a major step, and I want to talk about that and then talk about the directions that we hope to be going in. I noticed that, I guess, the Institute is banking and the law. Part of the problem, of course, has been the banking that was done outside the law, not in an illegal sense, but in a non-legal sense. When I came to politics and first began to work with people in the banking business from the public policy standpoint, which was in 1972 when I was first elected to the legislature, and I remember bankers telling me their mantra was, know your borrower. Well, today, not only do the people who are making the loans not know their borrower, they have no idea who their borrower is, and in fact, their borrower is maybe 0.1% of a whole lot of people. I mean, there's been a fundamental change. I believe that what we've seen is a case for sensible regulation. I was going to be giving a speech across the river about a month ago, and it was snowed out, and I'm looking to redo it. I'll give you a part of it now. The title was We Told You So, A Liberal Looks at Contemporary Capitalism. Now, people tell little fibs, and one of the fibs often told is, I don't like to say I told you so. Everybody likes to say I told you so. And I will tell you that it is one of the few pleasures that improves with age. I can say I told you so and I don't have to take a pill before I do it, while I'm doing it, or after I do it. I can just say it. And there was prevalent in the world for a while, and I mean the world, not just the U.S., but the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, something called the Washington Consensus. It was politically and intellectually somewhat dominant. It was the Ronald Reagan philosophy of governance, but it was increasingly important in academic departments of economics. You would see it in the financial pages of the newspapers. And the general notion was that government was doing more harm than good much of the time, and that the market could be left to its own in its extreme case. But this was the dominant political philosophy in the Congress from 1994 until last year. Dick Armey, a PhD economist, was one of the leading economic spokesmen as the majority leader of the House. And his motto was, government is dumb, markets are smart. The Washington Consensus consisted of telling countries throughout the world, including poorer countries, that they needed to balance their budgets and cut back on subsidy. And the World Bank today still puts out a report called Doing Business, in which the easier it is to fire people and the less vacation time workers get, the better you look from the standpoint of doing business. It seems to me a very outdated way to go. And so, you know, places, I think Saudi Arabia beats Finland on this scale. It's something, it's literally something comparable to that. We've raised that question. When I became chairman of the Financial Services Committee a year ago, after the November election, and I was about to be the chairman, and that had been a subject of some conversation in the political world. There was actually an ad that some Republicans were using that said that people should be wary of voting for a Democrat for the U.S. House, because then the chairs of the committee would be John Conyers, an African-American from Detroit and Judiciary, Charlie Rangel from Harlem in Ways and Means, and me. And when Charlie first saw that ad that said, be careful, you're going to get Charlie Rangel, John Conyers, and me, said, boy, that's funny. I didn't realize Barney Frank was colored. but we were people worried, and what we were told was, you go back, this isn't that long ago, 15 months ago, back to November of 2006, you had the report that had been commissioned by Mayor Bloomberg and Senator Schumer, you had the report from Hal Scott at Harvard Law School, known as the Paulson Report, and the argument was, listen, America, you better deregulate your financial institutions in particular, or everybody's going overseas. People are going to go to England, where they can have the Financial Services Authority. IPOs aren't going to be done in America anymore. And the dominant view that I encountered literally 15 months ago was, you are overregulating in America and you better cut back. Today things are very different. Obviously there are areas where we can make regulation more sensible. But we are now in the midst of one of the most serious economic crises we have seen in recent years. Clearly, from the worldwide standpoint, the worst economic crisis since more than 10 years ago, 97 into 98, the Asian and Russian financial crises. And inadequate regulation is one of the major causes. People were worried about, you know, America overregulating. If you look now in the financial area, one of our major exports over the past year turns out to have been bad mortgages. The notion that America must deregulate seems less clear to people. And the important issue is what happened, and we have two aspects that we have to deal with. One, how do we deal with the current negative impacts? And two, what do we do to diminish the likelihood that this recurs? As I look at this, one very interesting fact, about a month ago, Citigroup announced a reorganization of its banking, of its mortgage department. And they had two separate entities, one that dealt with securitized mortgages and one that dealt with mortgages that had been originated in their banks. And they were going to merge the two. They have merged the two. And they noted that the record of the securitized mortgages was much worse than the record of the mortgages that had been done in the banks. 20 years ago and more, and there are obviously bankers here who can correct me if I got the dates wrong, but it does seem to me 20 years ago and before that, The overwhelming majority of residential mortgages were made by regulated depository institutions. Basically, you had banks and thrift institutions that took funds from depositors, and because they were funds taken by depositors, they were fairly heavily regulated by either state or federal regulators or both. And bank examiners would come around, and if you had made a lot of loans to people who had no remote chance of paying them back, you would have some explaining to do to the bank examiners. And you had the know your borrower. Over this past couple of decades, and I don't know exactly what happened, a competing form of mortgage origination grew up. That is a form in which people lent money to people. We should note that initially, going back, people lent the money and then expected to be paid back. The banks held the mortgages. And when you lent the money, you expected people to pay you back. And you also were lending with depository funds, so people were checking on you. Increasingly, in recent years, loans are made with funds that were not given by depositors. Pools of money grew up for a variety of reasons that were available for loans, and loan originators grew up who were outside the banks and who were making the loan with the purpose of selling it. So that you increasingly have loans now made by people who make the loan, sell it, get their money, and have no further need to worry about it. That's securitization, and it has a lot of advantages. One of the things that we need to deal with generically is, and I'm glad to see that Secretary Paulson has acknowledged this. As I've said, Secretary Paulson has turned out to be, I think, a very responsible and an important and constructive partner for the Congress. We've had three secretaries of the Treasury under this administration, and I'm now prepared to go out on a limb and say that having been in the financial sector, as Secretary Paulson was, is better preparation for being Secretary of Treasury than either aluminum or railroads, which were the jobs of his two predecessors. And he has said, and Ben Bernanke has said, we have this good and bad aspect of our situation. There is a tendency for innovation to outstrip regulation. Now, innovation is obviously a good thing. And to some extent, innovation is self-policing, because if you come up with a brand new idea and it doesn't produce any real value to people, it's going to sink of its own weight. Innovations that do not add to the ability of people to profit don't go anywhere. The problem, though, is, and this is what we've seen with securitization, innovation can outstrip regulation. We have a lot of sensible regulation still that applies when banks make mortgages with depository funds. We have virtually no regulation, it turns out, when mortgage brokers go to pools of money and make loans in that way. And it is not that mortgage brokers are inherently morally less trustworthy than bankers. The difference here is whether or not there is sensible regulation. And what's happened with securitization is that an increasing number of loans were made by people who did not have to worry about being paid back by the borrower. And it turns out that that lender-borrower relationship imposed a discipline in the financial system that we had undervalued. Now, we were told that, oh, this is going to be replaced. How do we replace the discipline of the lender-borrower relationship? Well, by something called risk management. And risk management could be very complicated, and it involved very arcane quantitative models, which I was readily acknowledging that I didn't understand. The fact that I didn't understand the quantitative models that were providing risk management was not as big a problem, apparently, as the fact that the people who were running them didn't understand them either. And in consequence, you have this, I mean, people tell you they don't know what they had and what they didn't have. And this is the issue for us. And it's a specific issue, but it's an example of a generic issue in the regulatory field. How do you allow an innovation to flourish and give you the benefits that people have come up while diminishing the abuses. You obviously never hit the optimal point where nothing bad happens and only good things happen. But you can bring it closer to that line. And it's specific, not just in subprime mortgages, although that's the current crisis, but we see this in other areas. How do you get the benefits of people being able to securitize loans and therefore increase their capacity to make loans and increase liquidity? How do you let people make, how does the system allow people to make a lot more loans while reducing the quantity of bad loans they make? Because it turns out that risk management, a major part of risk management was diversification. Well, that's okay, there may be a few bad loans, but they're going to be diversified. But it turns out if you put enough bad stuff into the system, diversification does not help you. And in fact, it spreads the problem. And that's what we are doing. Now, I will give you some tentative suggestions that we are... And by the way, this is a big argument of regulation versus deregulation. People say, well, this is just hindsight. No. And that's why I say, we told you so. There have been debates going on in American politics. Actually, I've just talked about one of them. Regulation versus deregulation, or as I would phrase it, I think many on the liberal side, myself certainly, agree that too much regulation can be a problem. But we've also tried to argue that too little regulation can also be a problem. We were on the defensive on that. A related issue, I won't get into it in any great detail here, just to mention it, is the question of income distribution. For years, many of us on the liberal side have been arguing that the free market system, which is the great way to create wealth, creates wealth, obviously, very effectively, but could do it in a way that exacerbates inequality. Obviously, you need inequality in a capitalist system. It's necessary. It's a good thing. But too much of it is not. And we were dismissed in that. And by the way, including in the mainstream journalism, you go back 10 years and you would see in the financial pages of the New York Times, generally a liberal newspaper, a good news, bad news story about the economy. The good news is that profits have gone up. The bad news, wages have gone up. And it was bad news when wages went up, even if wages were going up less than inflation. They've sort of corrected that now. The minimum wage is an example. 15 years ago, there was a pretty strong consensus in the academic economics departments that those of us pushing for increased minimum wage were just pandering. We may have meant well, but it was not going to work. There's been a real reversal there. Alan Binder at Princeton has been very good at acknowledging that. That, in fact, in the right conditions, raising the minimum wage has no negative effect on employment. You don't hear people now dismissing our concerns about the tendency of this economy to concentrate wealth in too few hands. It's no longer being dismissed as class warfare. But as recently as the 2004 presidential campaign, John Kerry was somewhat inhibited from raising these economic fairness issues because they said you're engaging in class warfare. I think the best single answer to that came from Warren Buffett, who said, oh, yes, we have class warfare in America. My class is winning. The statistics are now overwhelming. Don Evans, who was Secretary of Commerce under George Bush and a close friend of the president, released a report a couple of months ago documenting that in the last 7 or 8 years, only 5% of the population has gotten increases in compensation in real terms, in hourly compensation, that 95% have gotten either nothing or, in many cases, more people have had an erosion than a gain. But let me go back to the regulation. I think, and the parties are different on this. You know, one of the great, and the president referred to my defense of gay rights, self-defense of gay rights. I would tell you when I won Republican, I talked about the campaign in 2006, campaign against his Democratic opponent said, don't vote for him because Nancy Pelosi will be Speaker and she'll let Barney Frank implement the radical homosexual agenda. And I spoke to a group afterward and said I felt inadequate because this guy lost badly, the guy who said that. So apparently there was in at least one part of the country a demand for a radical homosexual agenda, 64%. And I felt unprepared because I don't have one. I mean, what I am supporting on the gay rights side is the right to join the military, get married, and hold a job. Now, what self-respecting radical in history would consider joining the military, getting married, and going to work as a radical agenda? But I will tell you, these days I find the need much more often to defend myself as a partisan. There is this denunciation of partisanship. We're supposed to be post-partisan. And I will tell you that as I listen to some of this debate, I suffer from post-partisan depression. The fact is that there has never been in the history of the world a self-governing polity of any size where you did not have political parties, not because anybody created them, but because human beings trying to govern themselves need some forms of organization. And parties in America mean a great deal. Now, partisanship can have a bad aspect. It can go too far, and it can poison your ability to cooperate when you should be able to cooperate. But it shouldn't be sort of ignored as if it didn't exist. Let me give you an example, and it has to do with subprime. In 1994, the last year the Democrats had a majority before this current year, Congress passed the Homeowners Equity Protection Act. There was a debate about whether that acronym should be pronounced HOPA or HOEPA, but it's the Homeowners Equity Protection Act. It empowered the Federal Reserve Board to make rules for mortgages even for institutions that were not banks. That is, it recognized that you had loans being made, mortgage loans, outside the banking system. And it empowered the Fed to do that. Now, it wasn't as well-dressed as it could be, because as the Fed pointed out, they had no enforcement powers in some areas. But it did give the Fed the right to set rules. From 1995 until last year, the Federal Reserve explicitly refused to exercise that authority, because Mr. Greenspan believed firmly in the power of the market to self-regulate and thought regulation would be hurtful. This year, the House passed a bill to regulate subprime mortgages, and the Federal Reserve under Mr. Bernanke has begun to act there, although not as vigorously as some of us would like. 2005, a group of Democratic members of the Banking Committee, the Financial Services Committee, and one Republican began talking about a bill to deal with subprime abuses. The negotiations were going forward, not as fast as people would like, they were going forward, and then the Republican leadership of the House ordered them to stop because that was an interference of the market. There has been this difference. And as I said, I think the evidence is now clear that too little regulation can be damaging as well as too much regulation, and in particular, when you get great innovations that provide a lot of benefit, the job is not simply to sit back and admire them, but to figure out how regulation can be upgraded so that you get some of these benefits without the abuses. And the key here is in the area of lending. We have got securitization, which gives us great benefits, but diminishes the discipline of the lender-borrower relationship, and we need to know what to do about it. Now, in some areas, what we're going to do about it is simply to say, you can't make those loans. The House passed a bill, the Senate is going to be acting soon, I hope, that says nobody, whether you're a bank or a mortgage broker or anybody with any funds, can make a mortgage loan to people who really don't have much chance of paying it back. Now, in fact, I believe that is the rule that bank examiners would have imposed on any depository institution if they tried to do otherwise. And in fact, if you were the one who was going to get paid back, you'd have very little incentive to do that. We've also passed a law that said, please don't lend people, not please, don't lend people money that's worth a lot more than the house you're taking in collateral. Now, so I was saying, one of the things we're going to do is to apply some rules about what to do and not do. But obviously, you can't and shouldn't try to regulate by figuring out every bad idea, every bad loan. You can do it in the subprime area, that's a very special case. So we've gone beyond that and what we're thinking about. One, what we're trying to do is to find some way to give the people who make the loans and then sell them some skin in the game. That's essentially the issue. One way is to at least have these things put on the balance sheets. Now, we run into the problems. I asked Chuck Prince before he left, what was the justification for the structured investment vehicles not being on the balance sheet? He said, well, if we put them on our balance sheet, we'll be at a disadvantage vis-a-vis being a bank, vis-a-vis the financial institutions that don't have to put them on their balance sheets. We are talking now about everybody having to put them on the balance sheets. One of the things I think we have to confront is this. Congress passed, the President signed, the bill that repealed Glass-Steagall, removing many of the functional barriers that kept banks and securities firms from doing the same thing. But the regulation hasn't caught up with that innovation. Banks are subject in some ways to more regulation than the securities firms with which they're competing. One of the things that I think we need now to do is to look at functional regulation and forget about that previous distinction. I mean, it turns out that whether the funds were given by depositors or not no longer should have as much importance, and we need to regulate some of these other institutions as well. So what you're talking about, everybody puts it on the balance sheet. We're talking about more reserve requirements, not just for banks, but for all institutions. And again, the theory, the notion is, how do you replace the discipline of lender-borrower by a set of procedures that instruct people to be more careful, or not instruct, but build in incentives to be more careful? Now, there's one especially somewhat radical. It comes from the Financial Times, from Martin Wolf, who says he believes the problem is that the financial incentives built into the compensation of the top executives of the financial institutions is what's driving them, because they have a one-way ratchet. If they take risks and they pay off, they get a lot more money and keep working at high pay. If they take a lot of risks and they don't pay off, one or two things happen: either nothing, or they leave with a lot of money. And the disincentive for taking risks that fail, he is arguing, aren't there. That one I'm still open on, but it's a very plausible argument put forward by a very respectable and not terribly radical leader. So we are clearly in the area of needing to do more regulation. And that also means, I believe, and it's long since past due, we've got to enhance the ability of the regulatory entities to do their job and pay well for the people who are there. Now, at the same time, there are areas of deregulation that make sense. I have been very supportive of the decision by the Securities and Exchange Commission, or the work by the Securities and Exchange Commission and the European Union, to have convergence in the regulations. One of the things that they are in the process of doing is saying that we will accept each other's accounting, that we'd have a problem with the two different forms of accounting. One argument was, okay, come up with a common accounting method. That would take forever and just, I think, bog down. Instead, what we have is a very sensible notion that European and American regulators will accept, I believe, the accounting standards elsewhere. There are other things we can do to cut back on excessive regulation. I was supportive when the SEC just cut back on the extent to which you needed to do certain things to comply with Section 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley. I think Sarbanes-Oxley made sense, but in the implementation, we went too far. They actually violated the principle, because in deciding how much accounting would be required under Section 404, they essentially left it to the accountants. And that violated a very important principle of human life. Never ask your barber if you need a haircut. It's not that people are selfish. It is that all of us like to believe that what we do is important. And there is a tendency for all of us to overstress the importance of the contribution we make to the sum of human happiness, and needs to be able to check. So it is possible for us to deregulate some areas and regulate in others. We are going to be in our committee putting forward a set of rules. I'll give you another area where I want to deregulate. After 2001, we passed various legislation requiring the banks to send us suspicious activity reports. They go to the Financial Crimes Network, and they get, I guess, the Financial Services Roundtable told me the year before last, they got a million. We sent a million of them. I don't think there's a federal agency capable of handling a million anything. We don't give them, I mean, so essentially what we've done in the area there, frankly, I believe, is tell the law enforcement people to find some needles, and then we build them the hugest haystacks imaginable. And we are trying to thin out the amount of paper that has to be sent by the banks. So it is not that we've given up on cutting back on regulation, but there are some fundamental issues in which we need to increase the scope of regulation. Let me say, I'm going to throw this open now. I do understand there are people who tell us that by doing that we are going to destroy the markets. Interestingly to me, when I talked about the differences I've had with some of my friends in the capitalist area, we have been arguing, and this is where I say we told you so, that too little regulation can also be a problem, not just too much regulation, and that growth is a good thing, but some public policies are needed to try and prevent growth from happening entirely unequally. One of the arguments against those positions has been, frankly, an underestimation of the strength of the capitalist system. We've been told, for instance, if we let the Bush tax cuts expire, that will do enormous damage to the capitalist system. If, in fact, we let the Bush tax cuts expire for people in the upper brackets, they will go back to the level that they were at after President Clinton got us to raise them in 1993, after which we had a terrific economy. In fact, some regulation can be helpful. I know people said, oh, if you regulate, you're going to destroy things. If you really want to read the argument that regulation will inevitably be destructive of the free market system, made with passion and eloquence and conviction, go back to the congressional record in the 30s and read the debates about the establishment of the Securities and Exchange Commission under Franklin Roosevelt, because you hear very much of the same arguments. I mean, the fact is that the capitalist system, this great free market system with the individuals doing what they do, now with an economy of, what, $14 trillion, it is much stronger than some of my conservative friends imagine. And I believe that there is a wider range of public policy choices that we can make that will affect income distribution and may affect some other things without endangering the capitalist system one way or the other. And that's where we now are. So you are going to see in the financial services area our view that increased regulation to catch up with the innovation, particularly in the area of securitization. By the way, that subsumes, and one of the things, we should have said this earlier, when I took office, I had some friends say, oh, you got to go after private equity and you got to go after hedge funds. It does not seem to me that, and I think we've been borne out in this, it's not that hedge funds present some new and special difficulty. To the extent that they've participated and helped promote the funding for securitization without the responsibility, yeah, they're part of the problem. But it's not the form of the institution that engages in the activity. It is the activity of significant lending and then selling off the loans and not being able to keep track of who's got what and to whom. That's what we have to deal with. And our challenge is, as I said, to reimpose the discipline we had before securitization became so widespread without losing the benefits of securitization. Obviously, that is more easily conceptualized or said than done, but that's what we will be working on. And now Ollie will be glad. Con's going to join me, I guess, and we're just going to throw this open.
Thank you very much. My role here today is simply to stimulate some discussion, and I'll start by asking a couple of questions of the congressman. But first, I want to echo the thanks of Dr. Brown for your being here today. It's an honor to have you here. My first question was posed by Dr. Brown. He wanted me to ask you, in this election year, with Senators Barack Obama and Clinton going towards deadlock, do you see any circumstances at the Democratic Convention, if there is deadlock, when you would be a vice presidential candidate too, Mike Gravel?
No, I'm not prepared to invite the Secret Service into my private life.
I think that the current administration probably has already seen to that.
The other thing, too, by the way, mathematically, and I've had this conversation, you cannot really have a deadlock with two candidates. I mean, it's a majority, and so with two candidates, it would be very hard to have a deadlock. With three or more, you can. But, this may go late, but I don't know how two candidates, how both of them fail to get a majority. Yeah. So I think we're not going to have that.
But on a more serious note, assuming there is a changing of the guard in Washington come a year from now, how do you see that changing the debate, if at all?
You've got both. Look, I think one of the things about the Democratic presidential race this year that's striking is how little difference there has been among the serious candidates on the issues. I mean, people here will go back to 68 or 72 or 76. There are many fewer differences. In fact, one of the problems I think that you've seen, and one of the reasons it got a little nasty between Senator Clinton and Senator Obama, is they don't really differ on any important public policy issues. And, you know, if you're in a campaign, what do you do when there are no differences? You got to give people some reason to vote for you. And it leads to, I think, what was originally written, I believe, about academia, the narcissism of small differences was the article. And people tend to get too focused on too little. But I think on the issues I talked about, there were these debates when President Clinton came in office, with Secretary Rubin and others. There were many Democrats, including many in the Clinton administration, who argued that, for instance, growth was what we should do and that you shouldn't get into income distribution. And there was a worry about regulation. After all, the repeal of Glass-Steagall happened with the strong support of the Clinton administration. And the notion that free trade was an unmitigated good and that you did not have to worry about the distributional consequences, that was the beginning of the Clinton administration. President Clinton started out with NAFTA, but ended in Seattle at the World Trade Organization saying, I only want to do this if we have labor and environmental standards. And you have seen, people haven't fully documented, there's now been an evolution on the Democratic side. The debates within the Democratic Party about do we worry about distribution and do we talk about some increased regulation, those are over. And you now have, so that if the Democrats win, you're going to see a fairly united thing. Well, two things have happened. We've had the subprime crisis, and we have had statistics that show how much inequality has grown beyond what is necessary for a system. So I think if you, I should say this, if you get a Democratic president, a Democratic House, and the expected pickup, if that would happen, you'd get three or four at least more Democratic senators, maybe five or six, you will get some fairly significant changes. You will get, I think, House, Senate, and President that are strong believers in the capitalist system, as virtually every significant player in American politics is, but people also believe that public policy within that framework can increase regulation to prevent abuses and do something about income distribution. I think the differences are fairly sharp.
Just as a follow-up to that question, three major financial institutions announced standards by which they would lend to coal-fired power plants. We regulate financial institutions for community development, in the case of CRA, for anti-terrorism and anti-money laundering, in the case of Bank Secrecy Act, which you alluded to in your remarks. Do you foresee ever a day when we would regulate financial institutions with the value of human effect on climate change embedded in it?
Unlikely. I think the way to do that is not by regulating the financial institutions, but by regulating the borrowers. I mean, I think it makes more sense when you do that from the public policy standpoint to regulate the borrowers, not the lenders. If we think certain things shouldn't happen, then we should tell them not to happen. I think letting them happen and then regulating the lenders is problematic, especially because, you know, we don't control all the lenders in the world. And one of the constraints we have is putting American institutions at a disadvantage vis-a-vis other institutions. So I do think you're going to see an increase in the Community Reinvestment Act. And what we have is when the Community Reinvestment Act was passed in 1977, most of the activity that it dealt with was carried on by banks. And 31 years later, an awful lot of the relevant activity is carried on by institutions that aren't banks. And I think CRA has been helpful. And I think we plan to try to expand CRA, particularly to cover a lot of the institutions that now do a lot of the economic activity that banks used to do, and give them CRA responsibilities.
Bringing the discussion back to subprime and home lending, prior to the emergence of the subprime crisis last summer, I think home ownership in this country was approaching 70%. Could it be that we have maxed out in that area and it's time to concentrate on affordable
Absolutely.
Rental housing?
Absolutely. Home ownership is a good thing, but we made a great mistake as a society, and this is another area where I'll say I told you so, in which the home became the same as home ownership. There are people in the society who should be allowed to rent. Look, I wish everybody in America earned enough money and had enough sense of responsibility to own a home. I also wish I could eat more and not gain weight. I mean, I wish a lot of things. But if I act on that wish without the constraint that I'm in big trouble. And we clearly pushed people into home ownership and devalued rental housing. And one of the major changes that took place when we took over was we're getting back in the affordable housing business, including we passed legislation in the House this year that takes excess money generated by the FHA through home equity mortgages, which make a lot of money and have been pretty good. And we go to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And between those two, we have now got, through the House, legislation that creates an affordable housing trust fund, a low-income housing trust fund, with about $800 million a year. And we hope to get it up more. And so that's absolutely the case, that home ownership is a good thing, but we pushed it too far. There's another factor that we should look at, too, and that is, one, we push people in home ownership, shouldn't be there. The other thing that I should have mentioned and that requires more regulation is, and the UMass did the study, you know, one of the great things we've got now is the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, which my former colleague Joe Kennedy pushed through. It is still the case that there is a difference in your ability to get a prime mortgage based on your race and your ethnicity. And blacks and Hispanics are pushed into subprime mortgages more than they should be. And we intend to continue to push that. And I don't know whether, you know, some of it's explicit racism, some of it is other factors, assets or whatever. But there was a differential there that's been part of the problem. And that's another area where you will see more regulation from us. We are raising hell. If you get a president, then I think you're going to see even more of it who's committed to that. Mm.
One of the supplements to home ownership has been GSEs, government-sponsored enterprises, the Fannie Mae and the Freddie Mac. And you, along with Secretary Paulson, were instrumental in passing legislation in the House last spring. Do you care to comment on the prospects for that?
Yeah, I think it's going to happen. There's been some controversy. I think Gove had a piece that was very wrongheaded. I think Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been very important elements here. They have done securitization more responsibly. By the way, I know there were people who said, oh, there's been these fears. And we have an administrator of the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise, who's the regulator, who seems to me to have gotten carried away with his hostility towards them. And they keep predicting gloom and doom. In fact, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are housing-only financial institutions, have weathered this terrible housing crisis better than a lot of others. When we talk about stress tests to see if people are going to collapse, they've been through stress reality. And we do believe that they have a potential for more social impact. And the bill that we passed in the House, in addition to increasing the regulation and trying to make it more like bank regulation, takes, at the current levels, about $600 or $700 million a year from them and puts it into an affordable housing trust fund, and also increases the goals that we give them for sort of moderate income housing. The Senate had been holding back on that, but I think this crisis has now given us weight. Senator Dodd says he's going to move on it. Now, one of the pieces of that, as people may have read, and this was the goal piece, was we raised the upper limit of what they can securitize. As of now, until we pass the stimulus bill, the FHA, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, all were given $1 limit as to the value of a house they could work with. Well, one National Geographic limit in housing makes no sense. Housing, for obvious reasons, is the most variable price in the economy. It cannot be sensible. I mean, if $417,000 is the limit in Massachusetts, then it's way high for Nebraska. And in fact, what you need to do is to take it into account. We haven't gone into luxury housing. What we did was to say we'll go to the median house price. In the greater Boston area, it'll go up to $516,000. Anybody who thinks you're buying a luxury house in Boston or in this area, $516,000, doesn't know what he's talking about. But it's also the case that along with raising that limit, which increases the profits for Fannie and Freddie, we want to take some of the money and put it in low-income housing. I've got some people now saying, oh, don't raise the limit. You're going to hurt the poor people. And I guarantee you this is coming from people who have not previously had a word to say about the poor people. There is a hostility to Fannie and Freddie that is now masquerading as a concern for the poor from people who had previously managed to overlook their existence entirely. I think we'll get it so that Fannie and Freddie will be more useful. And yeah, there will be securitization there, but that's securitization, that's an example of what I'm talking about. What we want is to expand the role of Fannie and Freddie in securitization, raise the limit on what they can do, but with better regulation. And that's kind of the model of what we're talking about. Get even greater benefits from securitization in the housing area than we've had, but along with better regulation.
We ask that you state your name and affiliation, if you don't mind.
Hi, name is Fred von Krusenstern. I'm with COFAS North America. You mentioned earlier Secretary Paulson, and I was thinking about Undersecretary Steele talking about the regulatory blueprint that they expect to release this quarter. Thought maybe you could comment on that. And also whether or not you expected to see any federal regulation for insurance companies.
Obviously, the fact that insurance is not regulated at the federal agency at the federal level is sort of an anomaly, although it was a conscious choice by the Congress in the McCarran-Ferguson Act. It is, interestingly, one of the major objections that our European friends have against us in terms of, you know, we talk about openness, little side. They say, well, you know, we say the playing field isn't level because of this and that. I tell you one thing. One, I've made my economic discovery be my candidacy for the Nobel. People talk about the level playing field. We have a great phenomenon in America. You know, you have like a constantly downward sloping cost curve, et cetera. We have a constantly downward sloping playing field. That is, there are a whole lot of businesses in America that deal with an unlevel playing field, and in the history of the economy, none has ever been on the top. I have never encountered any institution that got any benefit from the unlevel playing field. They were all at the bottom of the unlevel playing field. Well, the Europeans tell us their problem is if you're an insurance company in America and you want to do insurance in France, you go to Paris. But if you're Lloyd's of London and you want to do it in America, you got to go to 51 jurisdictions. And there's a lot of pressure from them. There's also pressure from the insurance companies. I'll tell you what I think might happen, and there were some hearings, and there's a lot of dispute about it. First, people are going to have to bifurcate insurance. The argument for a federal charter for life insurance is different than the one for property and casualty. It is stronger. They all still face obstacles. Nothing's going to happen in the near term. But I think increasingly there are people within the industry now who are willing to say, okay, we'll look at life separate from property and casualty. I would tell you this. A lot of us, more of us who are in Congress, were members of state legislatures than any previous experience. I don't know many people who, having once dealt with automobile insurance and who no longer have to, want to do it again. The desire of members of Congress to get back into the automobile insurance regulation business is quite low. It is also the case that when you were talking about property or casualty insurance, you are talking about phenomena that are much more local. Life insurance, on the other hand, has become in many ways a financial product like many others. So there is a chance, and it's an open question right now, but I think you will see, and nobody's quite sure whether there'll be a consensus, but I think going forward, you'll see some difference, and you may, it's conceivable in a few years you'll have an optional federal charter for life. People can still do the state, but it's by no means assured. The other issue was on Paulson's regulatory thing. Well, there were two issues here. To some extent, a year and a half ago, there was some talk about deregulation. I think Secretary Paulson, Chairman Bernanke, both understand. In the areas that I've been talking about, we need more regulation. I mean, people walking around with all these massive amounts of debt on nobody's balance sheet, et cetera, that's not going to continue. What you will possibly see is a proposed reorganization of the structures. I mean, people have some envy of the British situation where you have the one entity, the Financial Services Authority. We have the SEC, the FDIC, the OCC, the OTS, the Federal Reserve, maybe a little the Federal Trade Commission, and the Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, for which there is no justification in my mind whatsoever. But the agriculture people don't think so. It started out as agriculture. It's not so much anymore. I would say this. If they were serious about trying to reorganize the agencies, and over and above the deregulation of the substance, there's an argument that can be made for rationalizing the structures. But it is way too late in the administration for anything to happen. So the secretary may propose something. What are they likely to propose? Well, there are two candidates for mergers, an OCC, OTS, the Control of the Currency and the Thrift Supervision, and the Commodity Futures Trading Corporation and the SEC. People can make a logical case for both. I do not think a political case is likely to be made for either in the near term. And I think we will end the year without any structural change there.
I think we have time for one more question.
My name is Don Noel, an adjunct faculty member here at the law school, and I've had some experience advising people on the low-income housing tax credit. You had mentioned about the need for more affordable housing. In my own experience, I had thought that was a fairly effective way to encourage it. I was wondering if there was any thought of expanding that tax credit.
Here's what we're going to do. One, we are talking about expanding tax credits, both for multifamily and for single family. Secondly, the low-income housing tax credit, one of the problems we now have people in the business tell me is we have two sets of programs that help housing for low-income people. You have the tax-based set, and then you have those that are based on appropriations, the community development block grants, the home program, et cetera. And when we won the election, Charlie Rangel and I, because Charlie has been a great housing advocate, we have had staffs of the two committees working all year, and we are about to get the numbers we needed from the Congressional Budget Office. We are about to pass a bill in the House, and I believe it will go all the way, that will take the tax-based affordable housing programs and the appropriations-based affordable housing programs and make them work together. The reason for that is picking high-cost areas like ours, no one program will get you to a low enough level of income. So we will make both of those work very much together. That will have the effect of expanding them because you will significantly lower the cost. And that's one of the things of which I expect to be the proudest. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank speaking on Lessons of the Subprime Crisis, part of the Edward Lane Redeker Speaker Series, sponsored by the Moran Center for Banking and Financial Law at Boston University's School of Law. Moderating the discussion was Moran Center Director Professor Cornelius Hurley. We began with an introduction by Boston University President Robert Brown. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild and Mike Toda, with help from Rachel Paste. Our web producer is Angel Cluzelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.